Auto Kennel Podcast, Memoirs of a Used Car Salesman. Today's guest is Charles Rollins. I have known Charles for probably over 15 years.
I was thinking about that back to Halloween parties at Devin's house.
Oh my God, that's right. Devin was just a mutual car friend of ours. And I worked with Charles at the Newport Beach Concours, which you were for what, 10 years?
I think I did 10 years, yeah. Your dad and you came on board and we were stewards together. That was fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing about Charles, I've always noticed, when we first met him, like I said, over 15 years ago, it seems like I would run into Charles in the weirdest car places. It would be at Monterey where, yeah, you'd see, you know, a lot of people. But of all the people, I would always find him there and sometimes his sister. There was one time where I was helping a friend at the Orange County Fair Demolition Derby, and I hear a guy yelling from the stands, and there's Charles at the Demolition Derby. So of all my car friends and automotive people I know, I probably run into Charles kind of like a Where's Waldo thing more often than not.
I felt that was encapsulated it, and I refer to Paul, I say everywhere from the Demo Derby to Pebble Beach, and that really puts it into perspective because we both will do almost anything car oriented.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And speaking of that, you've been in the automotive business for 30 plus years?
Yeah, started just out of college in the early 80s.
Okay. And were you what part of the automotive industry were you working in?
I got very lucky and was brought into a company up in Culver City that was one of the first remote control alarm companies to install. And remote controls were unheard of at the time. It's commonplace today. But it was funny. We would blow people away that something on their keychain could make their car talk to them. And at that time, the 320i was very hot. 911s were being stolen all the time. And there was this market for protection. And Clifford was not the predecessor, but Clifford had a system where you had to open the door. You had X amount of seconds to undo the system. And with smash and grab radios on the BMW, which we called Break My Window, it was gone before the alarm went off.
Oh, wow.
So the remote control gave it instantaneous as soon as we had a high-tech glass breakage sensor. As soon as they smashed the window, it would go off. Sorry, too late. You're in for a couple hundred dollars for a new window, but at least made enough noise to most of the time scare them away.
Any weird stories or weird clients you ran into when you were working in that, you know, theft deterrent industry?
Thinking back, I worked on a lot of really cool early Porsches that were original owner cars. I think the number one story that will always be remembered is getting guns pulled on me by the sheriffs who, when I was working on a car in a parking lot, I'd been there for over a half an hour. I had the keys to the car. I felt like saying to him, if I was stealing this car, I'm really bad. but to have two guns pulled on you, even though they were on the friendly side, was really unnerving. And I just, you know, showed them the keys and they called the owner and it was over with.
So you grew up locally, right?
No, I grew up in Silver Lake up in L.A.
Well, I mean, California.
Southern California. Yeah. Yes.
So, and just reading the background, it sounded like you lived around a lot of car people growing up or in that area or involved with them through family or...
We had some really cool people in the neighborhood. I'd have to point it to the fact that we had five early T-Birds in the neighborhood. And as you walk to school as a little kid, and we're talking primary school, and you see these cars where the people were driving them and they stood out. Because it's like, wow, look at this person. So that, let's say that was mid-60s, cars were already 10 years old. They were really unique. And we happened to have five of them in the neighborhood. I knew where every single one was. And then the other thing was Freiberger's, whose son is editor of Hot Rod Magazine, lived around the corner, and his father collected really interesting Jags and Mercedes. And that was just weird for people to have old cars in their garage. And so I was exposed to it for sure. And then by relationships with other, I had a friend in high school who drove an Alpha Boattail Spider and opened my eyes to foreign cars. I didn't really gravitate toward the muscle cars.
What's your kind of oldest automotive experience where you were, you know, maybe in a car, driving a car, stealing a car?
I'll have to say it might have been having family friends who went to Ontario Motor Speedway, and I really wanted to go, and no one in my family knew anything about cars or racing or anything. And
how
never
old were you, about
10?
Okay.
And not getting to go to Ontario Motor Speedway. So, and then put it, 10 is about right, because Hot Wheels came out there. I really liked Hot Wheels, and I didn't have enough money to, you know, collect Hot Wheels, but.
Your family thought you were weird. You were the only kid in your family into cars.
I knew we were a Ford family, and we were a Mercury family. My grandma had Mercuries, and I didn't really, you know, in retrospect, you get it. But, you know, she wasn't a mainstream Ford person. She was a Mercury. She needed that little bit extra. And then my parents would just, we had Mustang, Falcon Wagon, Mercury Grand Marquis, massive family truckster.
Oh, yeah, you got it.
So I didn't really put that, but, you know, there were Chevy and there were Ford families back in the day.
Was it just because it was just easier to go back to the dealer you bought the car from, give them that car and go get another one?
Probably, but I bet it was more instilled in your roots. If my father's father was a Ford guy, that probably came. I'll digress a little bit. One of our neighbors, had a Rover. He leased two Rovers back to back. You know, and had the three hood scoops and red, and it was really different. We also had old Mercedes in the neighborhood that was under a tarp, and it was still there when I went back in the 90s.
Where is it now?
Well, the people were going to restore it. I don't think there was much less. It was a 190.
An old 190?
Yeah.
Oh, neat.
But I don't think there was much left after being 40 years under a car cover outside.
Oh, yeah. So you're potentially one of the first people in your family to get something besides a Ford or a Mercury?
Yeah, a collector car, I would say that.
What was your first car that was actually your car?
Oh, you'd love this one. The neighbor had a 1960 Plymouth that got in a wreck, and they gave it to me for $1.
Sweet.
So if you're familiar with Christine...
Oh, yeah.
Christine was like a 57 or 58. This was a 60. So it had the 1 foot tall fins. It had a fake Continental kit on the rear trunk. It was just a shell that looked, you know, push button gear, the pivoting seats to get in and out. And so I did some research, which was going to the library at the time. There was no internet, to look at old ads and how these cars were painted. And so I painted it the two-tone white and red. White roof, red bottom, interior was still good, and drove that to college the first 2 years, and it was a real, quite a boat.
I always tell people, kind of like people look like their pets or remind them of their pets. For me, people I associate with their cars. They could have 30 or 40 cars in their lifetime, but there's always one car I identify them with. And for you, I identify you with the 64. The 64 Mercury Comet that was a recreation of, was it Ray Brock?
Yeah, my father-in-law's car.
Yeah, so I was looking a little bit, and I wanted to find out more because you're married to his daughter.
Correct.
Okay.
Which makes life very good for a car guy because she already understands what car guys do.
Did you meet her through the car world that way, or how did you end up getting involved?
Not at all. My wife's cousin and I went all through school together in LA, and it was mentioned that, you know, she was down in Irvine and I was in Costa Mesa, and we met and we had similar interests, and I'd met her parents previously because of the connection with her cousin. And as most people did, they, you know, you hear the name Brock and you think, is it Brock Yates? And then you have no idea who Ray Brock is until you look at Hot Rod magazine in the 60s and 70s and understand he was the publisher and editor and tech editor and all this other stuff. That was just a huge bonus.
Right.
I try to put it in perspective as somebody who's really into politics, but on the outside, all of a sudden in a week later, you're having dinner with the president and you get to go to all the VIP events. Mm. So what was very cool is Ray hadn't done anything for a few years, but here was new blood in the family. Somebody was interested in it. So we did Indy, we did Pikes Peak, we did Bonneville.
And you were treated like somewhat royalty.
Oh, front row, parking pass, press pass, wow. Sitting in Wally Park's private suite at the drag races and meeting all the luminaries, having the current drivers come in and, you know, touch base with the old guys, and my jaw hitting the ground, and it was very cool.
So when were you inspired to recreate the Comet, the famous Comet?
Ray didn't want to do cars. He actually had a shot at an original car previous to us meeting and didn't want any projects. So he passed away. I regretted not talking to him at length, because when you're in a situation, he's died suddenly, you're in a situation where there'll be time for these conversations.
To set the stage with what the car was, how, you know, what it did for Ray Brock.
In 64, Fran Hernandez, director of competition for Mercury, decided to prove that the Comet was this great car. So in November of 63, he rented Daytona Speedway and drove four cars 24 hours a day for 100,000 miles at an average speed of, I think, 114 or 117, and then used that in showroom advertising that this car can do 100,000. It was a durability challenge. He proved it. Now the next step was to prove that it's really, really tough and enter, quote, the toughest race on earth, which was a four-day, 1,500-mile drive across Africa. So he prepped cars, signed up drivers, some local two Indian brothers who were taxi drivers, who were great rally drivers, some American drivers. Parnelli Jones was entertained, but he couldn't take a month off. And then they hired Ray Brock, I assumed, to liaise back to the magazine and get more press. Ray actually was a talented driver. If you look back, he drove on the sand in Daytona. He drove in Bonneville. He drove this rally. He drove many years in 67, at least to 73, in Baja for the 1000, the 500, the Mint 400. He had a lot of wheel time. They did this rally. The cars were too large. The shock absorber towers broke. They limped across the finish line. He did win a trophy for the top finishing American driver. He's got a picture with this tremendously huge trophy. And then they came home, and some cars were shipped back, some cars were left there, and they ended up in Hawaii as race cars. And the one car that ended up in California was purchased by the guy who owned it up until recently, bought through Bill Strop's shop in Long Beach.
The ones who prepared the cars, right?
Yeah. Okay. Bill Strop built them out of Long Beach. That was the West Coast equivalent of Holman and Moody. They did all the racing stuff. Okay. So time goes by. I find myself paging through classifieds looking for another 356. And I'm like, why do I want another 356? It's kind of dumb. And then I looked at Comets and I go, oh, wow. Big back seat. We can take the whole family. Very unique family history with the car. And it was built on a Comet, so it wasn't like a special race car. And then spent a year or so researching and putting parts together and then assembling it. And that was, I think, in 2003. And here it is, 2015, and it still runs amazing. And we've driven it everywhere.
Yeah, you've driven, I've seen you do rallies, and you've taken it to the racetrack.
Yeah, I had the luck of the 50th or 60th anniversary of Carroll Shelby out of Pomona. I actually got to track the car, which I never intended to. It was a great opportunity, and the car was everything. And the coolest thing was I drove it there in the morning, and I raced it, and I drove it home at night, and everyone else had their motorhomes and trailers and everything else, and everyone really appreciated the car.
And you got to wear something pretty special during that. Didn't you wear his old race suit?
His suit and his gloves happened to fit.
Oh, great.
And I think that suit goes back to, they recreated El Caballo, which was a mongrel Model T with a Buick engine that they raced in the Mexican road race, I think 2 or 3 years. And Ray was kind of the crew chief on that. So he took off with Ack Miller and stayed with them and and worked on the car in the mornings and the afternoons when the car came in. So when the recreation got built, along with Ack and Ray's cooperation, the guy who built it put Ack and Ray in the car for the early days of the La Carrera. And the short story of the car, like, caught fire at the border, and they put the fire out, and there's in the, I think it's called Highlander, the Pink Floyd video, there's a picture of Ray and Ack sitting on a curb rebuilding the carburetors at the start of the race.
Perfect.
They got off late. They got lost. And these are two 70-year-old men in Mexico. They ended up at a junkyard. A Mexican guy pulled a gun on them. It was a really wild story. And I think they finally finished. But
wow,
a couple old timers.
So going back to you, I've noticed, you know, just over the years, you were always the one who volunteered for car stuff. You were helping out at the Newport Concours. You started bench-racing.com, which is really, I looked at it as just sort of a way to aggregate local events.
Exactly, yeah.
You put on the New Year's Day, the now famous January 1st Orange County.
Tour to Orange.
And how did that all come about?
I think, like yourself, going back to your early days when you, the Auto Kennel finally was, and you had the building off of Red Hill, I got to go on really cool events. The original Iron Bottom motoring tour. Two altruistic guys would put on this tour that allowed you to take your car out on the road and do basically what Martin Zwig was charging $4,000 to do. And with a group of really eclectic nutball people. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, I can give back a little bit. It's a friendly community. And so, you know, like yourself, you used to host pizza parties and have other luminaries come and talk to us, and there was no benefit to you. Cost you pizza.
Yeah.
And so the New Year's Day thing, Devin and I had done the LA version, and then you spend an hour and a half driving home. We're like, why are we doing this in LA? Let's go for it. Cars and Coffee at
Crystal Cove
was going on, and we launched it out of there with, you know, 30 or 40 cars, and it just took off from that. And then last year, the year before, I finally handed it over to somebody else because it got too big.
How I went, the year before, and it was 6:30 in the morning, and there's rock bands playing, yeah, and food, and I don't know how many cars there were.
It's up to 350 to 400 legit cars. And this is, if you watch the video and count the cars, not somebody's inflated number.
Right.
It's big.
It was.
But it's a wonderful way to launch the year.
Oh, yeah. You have nothing. And the amazing thing about January 1st is no one's on the road.
No one's on the road.
And it's not about going fast. It's actually about driving and not sitting in traffic to go through Orange County. And it's sort of like two car shows. One in the beginning, one at the end with a drive in between, which
right.
is and my favorite kind of car show.
Still to the, you know, this is the, I think the 11th or 12th year. You still get to In-N-Out Burger and people are still saying, wow, I've never been on that road before. So you're succeeding, you know,
exactly.
And I argued that it was the first car event of the year, obviously, because it started January 1st. But it also was about the only event where hot rodders and brand new exotic cars and European sports cars and muscle cars and the brand new car clubs, the Mini Club or the Mopar Club or the Smart Car Club, they all came together. And there was just nothing but smiles. It was exactly. It was a good event that there was no you guys and those guys.
Yeah, exactly. The United Nations of automotive.
It was.
Gathering.
It is.
The funny thing is, as I've known you over the years, you know, I thought you had a lot more cars than you did because it just seemed like every once in a while out of conversation, you'd say, oh, yeah, I have this car or that car. And for the longest time, I had no idea you were a Porsche guy. And you have two Porsches, right? And I think two of my favorite. You have a 911 and a 356.
Right.
Which came first?
Neither. In around the late 80s, because I always wanted a Porsche, and the Carrera was a magic word, an RS was probably 40 to 60. And that was a lot of money. But I did a little research and found in 74, they made a Carrera version with a ducktail out of the factory with very low production numbers. So I went for a Targa, which had 243 cars made. And I'm like, how can you go wrong I get to enjoy a Porsche. It's a super low numbers car. But that car never appreciated.
Yeah, it had a not a great engine, and that body style was not desirable until recently.
Yeah, I think that's funny. Because I got the Targa, and then I saw the coupe, and I go, ooh. And I lusted for a coupe. But you, so had that for quite a long time. And then, so probably let's say the kids started coming along in the late 90s. So sold it because it was just an extra car. And then missed it really bad. Lucked into my first 356 coupe. That was a work-related thing where an old-timer down in Mission Viejo, original owner of the car, 1962 356 Super 90 Coupe, calls me up to work on the alarm in his car. I'm expecting a late-model Porsche. He pops the garage, and here's this red coupe. And we start talking, and he's getting too old. His family doesn't want him to drive, and luckily 3 weeks later, I own the car. So that was number one. That allowed me to circle back and meet Rex and Jack McAfee, because it was Jack's factory demo back in the day.
McAfee is in the McAfee wheels that were...
McAfee wheels in the Porsche 550 Spyder, successful West Coast racer and Porsche dealer.
Mm.
So his son and I became friends back then, and we're best friends to this day, and we rally together and stuff. Then... I don't know if it's natural, you just want more power. So then I, at the time, 911s were 7 to 12.
Yeah.
And if it was priced right, you pretty much had to be on it. This is the early days of the internet. You had to be on it within 24 hours, it was gone.
Right.
And so I finally timed one out, bought it out of Arizona. The car cleaned up and got better and better and better. And it was a really nice car, and still have that. And that's a, you know how much fun.
What is that one?
70T.
Okay. It's a light ivory, right?
Right. Originally Irish green.
Is it a car you just drive, or are you going to restore it, or what's your long-term plan?
I would love driving it. So if it ever, something terminal happens to it, then I get to repaint it. But you know, I think it was a one owner car out of Colorado. Bought it out of Arizona, non-running condition with my fingers crossed.
Wow.
And just like I said, as you scrape back the layers, the paint buffed out, the engine's awesome. All I had to do was buy new carburetors.
Wow.
Redid the interior, but kind of a, not a beater driver, but a driver.
Yeah, something you can drive guilt-free on the rallies that you do and yeah. Things like that. Just real briefly, you know, you run a business that I kind of always liked growing up. You run Woody's Custom Shop, which I know you specialize in kind of modern version of vintage radios and accessories along that lines. But when I started going to your eBay store originally, I just would find these funky off the wall things that I call it, you know, I didn't know why, but I want it, you know, category. And it reminded me when I was younger, I would go with my dad to different automotive stores or whatever. And I could always find something I just didn't know I needed, but had to have. And when I first started driving, same thing. I love going to automotive stores. And your store kind of reminded me of an online version. I got bored looking at carburetor jets or wrenches. That didn't do it for me. But you had accessories, which I always thought were fun because, you know, low installation. You just buy it and stick it on your car and, you know, instant gratification. But how did Woody's start? And what is it really, or what were your goals with it?
I used to put together a booth for the annual swap meet, and I don't remember how far
which
Dunkel brothers.
Oh, the Porsche swap meet.
Yeah, okay. And I don't remember what years that was. And it left Dunkel's, and it was a rainy day at the Long Beach Memorial when it was they renamed it to the All German? No.
I remember that.
Something like that.
And it rained.
And it rained. And I'm driving home on the 405. Shaking my head going, why do I get all stocked up and dressed up for this one day? Because it wasn't my business at the time.
Oh, okay.
I had connections to buy all this stuff. And I would kind of stock up for the show, sell it off. And that was it. And with the advent of the internet and eBay and having a web presence, I thought, oh, why don't I try? Well, I had to sell off my extra inventory because now I had bought 6 antennas and I had 4 left.
Oh my gosh.
And They went very quickly. And so I ordered some more, and we grew from antennas, really, just a Hirschmann antenna dealer, which was something I understood and could guide people on. And then the radios were at the same place at the same time. And I would say I have two business tenants. One is, if more than like two or three other people are selling it, I don't sell it because there's no reason to. I don't want to sell it for 35 cents less than Stoddard's. It doesn't make any sense. The second one is, if I find a part that takes the place of a part that's stupid expensive, I'll go after that. And a good example of that, which is no longer available, were some fog lights that really looked, they were real glass and real chrome, and they looked like the early 911, 912 fog lights, and they were $49 a pair. And I think the fog lights are, what, $4.95 to $6.95, something like that. And you cry when you pick up a rock or you hit a curb and you bust them up. So that's a good example of what I try and source. I'm the driver guy. We do have some Concours parts. I think we have about 12 items that are exclusive to us as that have morphed out of, why doesn't this exist? Or we have an upgraded dash speaker. One guy was making it and he was charging way too much for it. So we kind of went that direction. So as an owner and you drive the car and you see the shortcomings, oh, this is a good idea. Why isn't anybody doing this? And once you make one thing, you kind of understand the radio plates.
Sure.
That was direct. The 356 had a cut up radio. They put in a cassette player, so they butchered the dash. Mm-hmm. And I looked at that for a couple of years. I couldn't figure out how to fix that. And then the 911 I got did not have the surround around the radio, and I couldn't figure out how Porsche could build a car with this gap around the radio. And you find out that there was a part that didn't really exist. A few guys had it and wanted a ton of money for. Well, with hooking up with a local laser cutting operation and their computer, we brought them the parts, they scanned them in, or we designed them on their computer, and we cut them at 100, you know, a shot or whatever it is. Right. And now I ship them and sell them. There's a couple big online stores that buy our parts. And, you know, I think we're doing a service because we're helping people who otherwise would have spent $75 and 4 weeks looking on the internet for this part to come available, and now they can buy it for $15.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the few, yours is one of the few destination sites I go to just to look at what you figured out, and that I sort of have these aha moments go, oh, you know, that's, you know, I've been sort of in the back of my mind thinking about that problem I've had with my 911 or any other car, and you seem to fix it. So your website, so it's mostly an eBay store.
It is, yes. And
so, but if you go to, how do you get to your store?
Woody'sCustomShop.com has a click to our store. I use that for the Woody'sCustomShop.com as kind of a platform. They can go there, look at pictures. We have our phone number, regular phone number, and toll-free phone number. I get very few calls. They go straight to the website. I think a lot of our clientele is older, and they still think that making a long distance call from New Jersey to California is going to cost a lot of money. but they still, if they have an issue or they don't trust the internet, they still want to be able to pick up the phone and have me answer it. Yep. And I talk to these guys, and they have to listen to a couple of their stories. And they're classic car guys from all over the United States.
You know, in terms of automotive regrets, cars that you've had or you missed out on, was it the 74 Carrera Targa, or was there another automotive regret that either you missed something or you sold something you shouldn't have?
I'm not going to offend anybody, but no, I don't want the Targa back.
I didn't think
so. But my name is attached to that car, so the three subsequent owners call me up and tell me that they've got my car and this and that. And unfortunately, I burst their bubble because the car had these really bitchin' factory Recaro leather seats that were in perfect shape because the guy had sheepskins on them. And the first guy that restored the car, I think, plucked the seats, put in a couple kind of 75 quote sports seats. And it's repainted, it's got the gold letters, and these guys are paying a lot of money for the car now, and it's a Concours car.
And the funny thing is, that car will continue to be in your life even if you don't own it, because it's too nice to do anything. You know, as some people say, it's getting close to becoming an immortal car, where even if it gets really damaged, it'll probably be resurrected. And so each new owner will probably pick up the phone, unless you change your number and call.
No, it's fun. It's fun to talk to these guys because they're so hot about owning this car. And, you know, it was part of my life. The guy I bought it from, this is a funny story. He was going through a deal. He was in Malibu, beachfront in Malibu. Original owner of the car, bought it from Westwood Porsche, had all the original paperwork. He had a girlfriend and a shrink, and the shrink told him he had to get rid of the car so he could move on in his life. And this was all part of get rid of the car and marry the girl. And I was the lucky guy to get the car, and I knew he was a fool.
Who was paying that psychiatrist?
But it was so funny. It's like, dude, getting rid of a car is not going to change your life. So it was the end of his chapter. And then I really got to enjoy it. Yeah. And it was fun. I will never forget living down at the beach, had that car. Weekday, you know, maybe Santa Ana's, or it's 80 degrees at 7 o'clock at night. And I jump in the car and they just opened the extension of Jamboree, you know, right, way up to... what's that road? San Diego Canyon Road. Right. And that was my route. I'd leave Newport, go up the 55 didn't exist. You go up Old Newport Boulevard, head up to Jamboree and just blast all the way up and all the way back in the, you know, night, dark, target roof off, headlights. And there's just like single guy
with his target,
the target,
bucket list items, any particular car that you really want that's attainable, that you've been chasing?
Not attainable anymore. My two cars going way, way back were a GT350 and an RS. And I would have done really well.
But yeah, you would have.
The flip side is they would be locked away and I'd be scared of them because they're too valuable. Yeah. So a good clone of either of those can get you on the road at a reasonable price and pretty much the same enjoyment without the insurance and the nail biting, and you'd go in and leave it unlocked and, you know, walk around a car cruise or whatever and not even worry about it.
Well, Charles, I want to thank you for coming in. For those of you listening, you can visit Charles' website at www.woodyscustomshop.com. And you can also go to autokennel.com, AUTOKENNEL.com, to see a link to the podcast as well as some pictures of the cars we talked about today. Thank you.
The introduction and closeout music is provided by Don Brennan. You can find his music at www.donbrennan.com or on iTunes. Thank you.